See, there we are. Wonder why the machine was not responding before. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This is time we're going to be in the TechNet. This will be TechNet number 1620. So, for later, you'll be hearing BasinNet report number 220. Technical Net is a gathering of curious amateur radio operators who want to know more about how the equipment works, how to make it work better, and it's intended to be educational, although I heard Rich KTUPS earlier today saying that these shows are very entertaining. It's a net, and it's a compliment that people call it a show and they call it entertaining. As I said, the original intent is education. We come together, the gathering, the clan of curious ham radio operators, and we teach each other as we go down the road of learning how all this stuff works. The magic of action at a distance, the fact that you can put a couple of watts into an antenna, and a person half a world away from you hears the fact that you're making a transmission and you establish communication with them. How in the world can that little bit of energy go that far, you know? 12,000 miles, so to speak. That much action at that much distance. There's a lot of magic involved. How that really takes place is something to have a lot of respect for, as I see it. And the subject of radio is continuously changing by a whole lot. I can remember. Let me drop it. I can remember on a TechNet in the late 80s, and by the way, the technical net began in September of 1982. So, this is our 34th year of the technical net. So it may be a record holder as far as the total number of years of service or years of existence under essentially one group of leadership, although it did slowly change, and also the total number of hours of TechNet. For it to exist that long, somebody must be appreciating it when they call it entertaining and a show, which is not quite the intent. But what I was starting to say is that as cell phones started becoming popular in the late 80s, I remember making a wild speculation that the day will happen when somebody is on vacation. Let me drop. On vacation in, say, New Zealand, watching a beautiful sunrise or sunset, becoming very enthralled by it, calling up his friend in California or New York, half a world away, and saying, yeah, I know I'm waking you up in the middle of the night, but my wife and I are seeing this beautiful scene by way of a camera that I've got, and I'm going to attach my camera to my cell phone. I'm going to play you the picture of what we're seeing of this beautiful sunset. I remember making speculations like that, that the day will come when the thing we call cell phone will have the ability to do things like that. Well, we've gone a long way since then. Now, all kinds of applications and global positioning and navigating, game playing, and whatever. The computer in your pocket now is many times the value or the capability of the computer that flew Neil Armstrong and the other astronauts, Buzz Aldrin and Mr. Collins, flew them to the moon. That was a computer that was a state-of-the-art in those days, and what you put in your pocket these days is a hell of a lot more than that. Okay, so you can easily come to the conclusion that the cell phone in your pocket is going as far as it can go. Not even the slightest. Let me show you what I mean by that. The latest issue of Microwave Journal, the September 2016 issue, tells you what the fifth generation of cell phones are going to be like when they're fully deployed, fully developed. The rate at which you can upload and download right now is reasonably good, but they're predicting in the next 6 or 8 years they are going to increase the rate at which you can get information into your cell phone by 10,000 times faster on the latest issue of Microwave Journal is predicting. In order to get that kind of upload and download bandwidth, that many megacycles of bandwidth, that many megabits per second, so that you can download live movies and things like that, it's going to require a lot of use of equipment that's operating. Let me drop. Operating at 10 gigahertz, 20 gigahertz, 40 gigahertz, 80 gigahertz. It's only in those microwave and millimeter wave bands where you have enough bandwidth. The good news is they've got the bandwidth. The equipment that will have to be developed to do that, to make a good frequency synthesized oscillator at 40 gigahertz. I mean, the words roll off the tongue real easily. To really do that in a small piece of portable hardware, it's not beyond the laws of physics, but it's going to require quite a bit of development. On top of that, those frequencies, to develop any significant amount of power there is very difficult, so it's going to be somewhat low power equipment running at, say, 20 to 40 gigahertz with enough bandwidth, but it's not going to have anywhere near the range of current cell phone sites. A real good cell site now might have a range of almost 6 miles, as long as there's a cell site every 6 miles while you drive along, you've got continuous communication. These new millimeter wave and microwave cell sites are going to be micro cell sites with ranges a small fraction of a mile. In some cases, they're talking about a 1,000-foot type range, so you're going to have some kind of a micro cell site on top of utility poles every 1,000 or 2,000 feet in order to carry this out. But there is the demand for that service. The cash flow is there, the customer demand is there, therefore to some degree, with some variation, it's going to take place. So if you think the automobile you're driving is going as far as it can go, the cell phone you're using is going as far as it can go, the television set you're using is going as far as it can go, not at all. There's a lot more coming. And so as we teach each other what radio equipment can really do, you'll be hearing more and more about that. The technical net has a loose schedule that we follow. Let me drop. A loose schedule where for the first hour or so we take people who sign in, and they're signing in with their call letters in their name because they do have a question or a comment for the net. The fact that you're listening, that's not required. There are many nets where a long list of people sign in saying, "I'm listening." Well, after 34 years and 8,000 hours or whatever it is of tech nets, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So the first hour or so, and it's a loose schedule, depending on the enthusiasm, that first section can be shorter or longer. That's followed usually by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag, monitors Echo Link and the chat room, and for people who don't yet have the right ham radio license or the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, they communicate with John. John selects a few of those submittals as to people wanting to know something, and we discuss those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tells us the latest at what NASA is doing, NASA and the other space agencies around the world. And last week, he listed for us the number of space agencies and the number of countries that have put things in orbit around the Earth. Let me drop. I don't know about you, but I was amazed about how many countries, how many organizations, how much equipment has been put into space. Tremendous amount. There's a lot more to follow. We're looking forward to James Webb Space Telescope and a whole lot of other very exotic pieces of hardware that are going to give us a lot more knowledge as to what's really going on out there. Awful glad to hear that the Hubble Space Telescope is still healthy and running, even though it was now roughly 1990, so that was, 26 years ago. That arguably is the most productive and the most appreciated piece of space hardware that NASA has ever issued. I'm glad that it's still running happily. But better equipment is coming. Alrighty, it's time for you guys to sign in if you do have a question or a comment. And hopefully we'll hear from KTUPS tonight, who's traveling slowly through Ohio or Pennsylvania. And he's always fun to listen to. And he tells us where he is, what he's doing. And there's another example of what modern-day electronics can do. of his rolling vehicle with his cell phone. He talks to us as if he's right on Long Island with us, right in our backyard, if you know what I mean. I don't think in 1970 or 1980, I don't think anybody would ever predict the kind of stuff we've got today that we're using. So at this time, let me drop.
DPZ with the quick answers.
We got Hal, K6DPZ, who at times gives us the very quick answers. Sometimes I add some information to them. So we get both quick and non-quick at the same time. And Hal and I don't always agree. So sometimes you get both sides of the story. Because there's more than one way of looking at things at times. People are going to sign in right now by giving me the call letters and their name. A typical sign-in would sound like this.
Repeater, timeout.
A typical sign-in would sound like this. WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me a call letters and name right now. K2RI, they'll be listening.
W2RIY, Joe. Yes.
Okay, we got Joe. Anyone else?
K-A-2-Y-H-Y. Good evening, Dick. No traffic, no question.
Okay, that was almost a perfect sign-in. The person gave us his call letters, but Steve didn't give us his name. Lucky Steve and I know each other very well, and that's why he didn't feel he had to. And I hope, as we proceed, I hope Steve will come up with a question. Steve and I talk quite frequently as he's on his way to and from his college, where he teaches, and we sometimes get into some pretty deep subjects of what Mother Nature is really telling us and what science is capable of doing. We don't have all the answers. And by the way, that's one of the things I should have mentioned about the TechNet. You're not going to hear 100% accuracy all the time. The smartest engineers I've ever known don't have a track record where they're about 1,000. We all make a certain number of errors. But by way of the almost peer-reviewed material that you're listening to, by that I mean the last 10 years of TechNet are recorded by a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI. And if you go to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor, there you can find all the past 10 years of TechNet, including this one. A few days downrange, this one will be there. So by way of that peer review, let me drop it. As we make errors periodically, and we do, somebody brings it to our attention, and people like Roy, AC2GS, for instance, a very smart guy, from time to time will bring to our attention that the way you guys worded that, there was such and such, and you may have created a misimpression, should have been worded this way. So he's one of the many people who sets us straighter. There's another website that's very complimentary to the technique, and that's Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's at limarctechnet.com, www.limarctechnet.com, and there you'll find pictures and articles and so on that are part of the TechNet. We drop. So by way of those kinds of peer review, the errors that we make do get corrected. We don't have 100% accuracy. And we try. Some of the engineers I've worked with could never admit they ever made a mistake. And they lived a more stressful life than they had to, from my point of view. So far we've got sign-ins of Joe and Steve. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet, primarily because you've got a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW listening.
KD2HUC, Steve, and yes.
Okay, Steve, Mr. HUC. And is it KD2, Kilo Delta 2? I missed the beginning of Steve. Correct me on that.
Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie.
We got you, Steve. Nice. So far we got Joe, Steve number 1, Steve number 2. Anyone else to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KDT, LVG, Chris is my name. Don't have a question.
some new rigs that have a very narrow band audio. LVG, Chris. If you do come back and talk to us, please shout into that mic a little bit more. And I bought a number of the Baofangs to try to find out which ones have got full modulation, which ones are the new mandated very narrow band technique by the FCC on commercial radios, which I think they're eventually going to find out is a mistake. Okay, we got more than enough to get started. Joe, when we last talked to you, you were doing an extensive search for ways of making better filtering of the electromagnetic interference that was coming from the light-emitting diodes, I think they were, that were part of your ceiling fan assembly. And I wonder how that project is going. And all kinds of radio interference are correctable to some degree. Let's see how... nothing's ever perfect along those lines. Let's see how you're doing in that one, Joe. W2LYY, H2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, that's not what this question is about for this week. That topic for last week will be tabled for a little while until I can acquire some parts. This comment and question related to it goes back to something I brought on the TechNet quite a while ago about measuring interference, or actually noise levels coming through an antenna. On a temporary basis, was able to solve my DC power problem. I couldn't run a piece of equipment in the mobile, a signal generator type of apparatus, and I was able to, temporarily solve that problem. So I was able to actually take the signal generator in the vehicle with me, use my directional coupler type of a sampling tap, and actually measure on a 52525 the actual noise level. The actual signal sensitivity of the receiver when connected to the mobile antenna. I hear this beep on your link. I'm not sure what that's all about. And I got pretty much the same results as I got inside the house. And it pretty much stayed fairly consistent as I drove around. So it wasn't something I'm seeing in like one location. I'm just wondering, and also getting to my question, is this the actual noise level I'm measuring, the noise level I'm actually measuring on the air, that just simply is there and that's all there is to it? Because the level was about 14 dB over the receive sensitivity of the radio is using, which is typically at least I'll call it minus 113 for 20 dB equaling. It's at least, it's better than that, but I'm using that as a standard figure. That's what the radio is rated for, as a standard figure. About minus 113 or 0.5 microvolts for 20 dB equaling. And I had to put a signal in about 14 dB.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh, all of you, you can have a discussion on that if you want. There were some places I found where some power lines, some sort of, KB lines, where the actual level increased substantially higher than that. I had to put about maybe 25 to 30 dB of level into the tap to be able to overcome the apparent outside noise. But for the most part, I got a fairly consistent signal, 14, 15 dB above that minus 113 dBm reading. Back to you.
Hey, you're getting into one of the fairly elaborate sections now of the radio science. Making specific power measurements in units of dBm per megahertz, microvolts per meter. There's a whole lot of different units that are used. In order to have a slight understanding of this, I'll tell you what I know, and that is... Was that you, Joe?
No.
Roger, Roger. Just want to make sure that you were... From time to time, I go off on a tangent that's different than your question, and you let me know about it. I thought it was possibly happening. If I started off at a frequency like 3 megacycles, and I connect a good antenna to a sensitive receiver, you're going to find that the amount of noise power of just the atmosphere, the ionosphere, and the millions of, the thousands of thunderstorms that are going on somewhere in the world, all of that man-made noise and also noise made by nature, gives you the equivalent of a 30 or 40 dB noise figure. In other words, the noise coming into your antenna on 80 meters on a good day 40 dB louder than the noise you would get out of a 50 ohm resistor at room temperature. That's what I mean by it's a lot of noise. You can tell that right away because as you connect the antenna to the radio and disconnect the antenna, quite often you'll see your S-meter move a significant amount. That noise usually falls off 6 dB per octave. Every time you double the frequency, you get half the amount of noise power. By the time you get up to 2 meters, the noise of the atmosphere on 2 meters is only a couple of dB above KTB, 114 dBm per megacycle. In other words, if I take a 50 ohm resistor, that's exactly at room temperature, and I make a very precise measurement. If my receiver was one...
Repeater, timeout.
If my receiver was like a radar receiver that had a 1 megahertz bandwidth, I mean, most of our amateur radio receivers only have bandwidths of numbers like 10 kilohertz, but if I had 1 megahertz of bandwidth, I would measure minus 114 dBm of noise power from a 50 ohm resistor, and an antenna on 2 meters aimed at the horizon is only going to give you a couple of dB louder than that. It's a fairly weak signal. To measure it well requires a low noise figure receiver, and things like a service monitor and a spectrum analyzer, a good spectrum analyzer until you add a preamplifier in front of it, almost all of them start off with a 30 to 35 decibel noise figure. It's a good sensitive receiver as far as flatness is concerned and being able to measure specific power at specific frequencies, but as a super sensitive receiver to hear threshold signals, no. Until you add a preamplifier, the spectrum analyzer, or the average service monitor is very insensitive. So if you drive around and if you're seeing noise on your service monitor going up and down, that noise, in my opinion, is real. It probably is man-made because Mother Nature, if you lived in a rural area where man-made noise is very far away and you've got a quiet power line system, you'd only see a couple of dB above KTB. A couple of dB stronger than minus 114 dBm per megacycle is what you would see. You did say minus 113. That's in the right ballpark if that's what you saw per megahertz. See, the funny thing about noise, let me drop.
That's not exactly what I said.
Now I'm going to turn it back to you for a second, but let me finish this thought. The funny thing about noise versus a signal, if I had a real signal coming out of a signal generator or a crystal controlled oscillator and I measured the power with a good spectrum analyzer, whether I used a filter, the resolution bandwidth filter, the IF filter, so to speak, on the spectrum analyzer, whether it was 1 megacycle wide, 100 kilohertz wide, 10 kilohertz wide, 1 kilohertz wide, I would measure the exact same of power on a narrow, real, coherent signal. Noise is not like that. Noise tends to be extremely broadband. It falls off 6 dB per octave, but rarely are we using a receiver that's an octave wide. So with the bandwidth of our receivers and the scanning that we do across that scan width, the noise power looks like it's flat. It's got a very slight slope going downward as you go up in frequency, but it looks flat. But the noise is broadband, and how much bandwidth you use to measure it determines what power you will measure. So you heard me say that a 50 ohm resistor at room temperature gives you an amount of noise power of minus 114 dBm per megahertz. I forget what minus 114 is. It's in the fraction, it's a fraction of a microvolt. So if it's got a megacycle of bandwidth, that's the power you'll measure. Go to half the bandwidth, you'll measure exactly half that power, 3 dB weaker. Minus 114 becomes minus 117 if you used a half megacycle filter. So that's the funny thing about noise. You can only determine noise power if you measure that power and tell the person who is listening to you making the measurement what bandwidth you made the measurement with. Let me drop. So, noise has to be some amount of power per megacycle. Or if you convert that power into microvolts, it's some number of microvolts per square root of bandwidth. Because power is a function of voltage squared, it's got that crazy set of units that look crazy. So go ahead and correct me on what I've said so far, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, measuring the receiver sensitivity through the coupler, well, through the receiver itself, the receiver is at least rated for 0.5 or minus 113 dBm. I first put a signal in to arrive at the first measure the receiver's sensitivity, which I know is good it's going to be anyway. The low band Motorola radio, they're pretty good on sensitivity, they're better than 0.5. 0.5 is minus 113, so 114 is a little less than, maybe 0.45, 44, something like that, what you were talking about. Now, once I establish that the receiver is working correctly, I put the signal into the tap with a 50 ohm load instead of the antenna. And that, you know, that gave me the lowest across the tap because it changes from 500 megahertz right out of the center in minus 50 to the low band. It's probably a difference of 60, maybe 70, 75 dB lowest across the tap, across the center. But I want it that way. So once I had the generator to, cranked it again to give me the 20 dB noise quieting, I then connected the antenna. Now I had this is where I had to raise the thing to about 14 dB higher than that level. And that level pretty much stayed consistently wherever I went. Only in some places, even very close to the house, I would have to increase the generator maybe a factor of 5 or 10 dB higher than that level again. And when I did that, I would stop at that particular exact location and take the antenna from the mobile and put that directly to the spectrum analyzer. And on that frequency, I could start seeing the noise. It looked like broadband noise, like a hump, or just like very wide. I could actually see on the analyzer, because the analyzer really will not see stuff better than minus 100. That's about the noise floor, pretty close to it. But occasionally, I would get near some power line things.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Meters. And those levels, as I got near those particular phone poles, would be as high as minus 50, minus 55, minus 60 dBm coming down the antenna into the analyzer. And that would really not, you know, wipe buffers. You could hear it in the background. But generally, that 14 dB figure above the receiver's normal sensitivity was a pretty much consistent level wherever I went. It didn't really change that much. And my question, that's what goes back to my original question. Am I actually just simply measuring accurate noise on 52 megahertz? Back to you.
One of the first tests I would do in your case, Joe, you have the ability to do this. Watch your signal strength indicator, whatever it is. Disconnect the antenna and watch the signal indicator. And then, just to be double down sure, put on a 50-ohm good termination to where the antenna was. Because there could be various ways that your instrumentation is creating noise that you don't know about, your automobile is creating noise, and so on. So if you come down to a much lower noise power with the antenna disconnected, particularly with a 50-ohm termination, they'll now be confirming your electronics, and when you put the antenna back on, that's a pretty strong indication that that signal is really there, and it shouldn't be there. At a 2-meter frequency or a 450 frequency, if you measured noise a couple of dB above the noise of a 50-ohm resistor, I'd believe it. If you measure something 8, 10, 15, 20 dB above a 50-ohm resistor, then something unusual is going on, probably man-made. So I wonder if you had a chance to do that kind of experiment, Joe, if you ever did disconnect the antenna. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, the receiver I'm using is an FM receiver. It's a normal bandwidth receiver for low band, except for 20 kilohertz channel spacing. So the bandwidth might be 13, 14 kilohertz bandwidth, something like that. Maybe, you know, plus or minus, maybe a little less than that, actually. But it has no indication of the signal level on the radio itself. You simply have the indication that either something's there, like a carrier, on channel carrier, or not. And it didn't, it doesn't change, they put the antenna on to off. So whatever I'm looking at isn't just considered broadband noise. The receiver just simply interprets it as broadband noise, not a carrier actually on channel.
Yeah, well, you called your receiver that you did this experiment with as an FM receiver, and an FM receiver almost always has a limiter. And to measure the voltage or something that takes place before the limiter, you can measure noise power. After the limiter, if the receiver was of good design, usually there is enough radio frequency gain in the RF stages and IF stages such that with just the noise of the front end of the receiver, you have enough power to start saturating the limiter. So therefore, to listen to what's coming out of the limiter and try to make a judgment as to whether or not a signal is there, you stand a chance, because a real signal in the middle of the channel will give you some quieting of the limiter. But if you're turning on various amounts of noise in front of a limiter, and you listen to the output of the limiter, you'll hear almost nothing changing. So the limiter is already saturated by the noise of the gain stages of the receiver, and additional noise coming into the antenna doesn't really make it any difference. A saturated limiter with a stronger amount of noise power is still saturated. I may be misinterpreting you, but if you were trying to make a judgment of what you heard out of that limiter discriminator of an FM receiver, that's a rather difficult measurement when it comes to noise power measurements. There are ways around this, but let me make sure I'm not going off on a tangent on this one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, well, first of all, the limiter inside the radio, you keep on talking, going back to that, that's contained in a single chip. You can't get at it, you can't make measurements like you think you'd like to make. It doesn't work like that. It's a single chip, like 14-pin chip, and it's doing all the limiting and processing inside the, it's like where the second local oscillator is located in that chip also. So it's all done internally, you can't get at that. You can look at the IO stage before, but the radio is an assembled radio. I'm trying to just really just get a better idea if I'm simply measuring something that just simply is there as atmospheric noise. Now, of course, I could turn off my signal generator, you know, and of course it goes away. I don't hear a carrier anymore, but the carrier level, like I said, was about 14 dB higher than the -113 sensitivity rating of the receiver. So it makes my effective sensitivity something like about 99, 98, or 100, something like that, as far as sensitivity. That's what seems to be my actual on-channel sensitivity that I'm actually experiencing. And that's what I'm seeing. And only in some places did I see that level go up about another 5 to 10 dB higher than that. When that happened, I could take the antenna and put it on the analyzer and see if they, at the same frequency my receiver's tuned to, that yes, I could see broadband noise. That the instrument could actually detect, you could actually look at. It looked like simply broadband noise, like if you were looking at a digital TV signal with a narrowband receiver, you just hear open noise when you listen to the carrier. Only every once in a while I hear line noise coming from some particular near transformer or some high voltage junction, and that you could actually hear that buzzing in the background. But what I was experiencing most of the time was just simply a broadband noise. Like I said, this goes back to my original question. Am I just simply hearing...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Joe, well, what you're doing is rather clear to you. You're giving us a series of words that I'm trying to make sense out of it all. I've already got a partial picture. I have the impression that your major sensing that you're doing as you're driving around is by using an FM receiver that has a built-in limiter discriminator assembly inside of a chip that you can't get to. I presume you're listening to the output of that receiver, and when you encounter an amount of noise, I am guessing that you turn on a signal generator, put the signal generator on channel, find out how much you have to crank up the signal generator to get some amount of quieting, like maybe 12 dB signet or 20 dB of noise quieting. I am guessing you're using the signal generator to find out how strong you've got to make the signal generator in order to quiet the discriminator, in order to then sense the amount of noise power that's coming into that FM receiver. That's my guess. Is that approximately what you're doing, Joe? To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Once I put the signal on from the generator, I leave it on. I never turn it off. So I'm constantly hearing this 20 dB quieting signal in the receiver's speaker all the time as I drive around. This is what I could not do before. And I, like I said, in almost all cases, at a pretty much consistent level. It doesn't really change. Sometimes, as I get near some locations that have some sort of noise being emitted by some device, they'll actually make that carrier get much, much weaker in apparent sound. I have to increase the generator's level by 5 to 10 of decibels of signal level more than what I originally had it set for. But, yeah, I'm driving around with the generator sitting on one side of the seat in the car hooked to this tap, and I'm running the carrier on frequency, and it's supposed to do all the radio traffic on, like, 52.525, so I don't have something else bothering me out in the distance. So I'm running this generator all the time. I'm not turning the carrier on and off. It's just being run continuously, just as a sampling. And I'm listening to the recovered speaker of audio out of the radio itself. That's what I'm typically doing. That's what I was a little mystified that I'm getting a fairly consistent level of 14 dB higher than the signal required that the receiver normally wants to hear. Knows what I'm listening to is my effective sensitivity of somewhere around minus 100 or worse. Seems to be a pretty much continuous thing that I'm listening to.
6 DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal. I've got a lot of comments on this one. Go ahead, Hal.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know what type of T-connector or coupler he's using, but many years ago, I came up and I use all the time. It's called a Magic T. I can tell everybody how to make it very simply, it's very cheap, and it's very accurate.
What I have is made by Bird Electronics, I believe. It's an adjustable sampling tee. And I have it set for 50 dB a drop at 450 MHz, and the drop will increase as you go lower in frequency because of the capacitive action of the tee itself.
Joe, your particular tee, which is a non-directional coupler, and you could use a directional coupler, at the frequency you're doing the test, you have measured the amount of insertion loss that T is giving you. Let's assume now it's giving you exactly 50 dB in my example, and therefore you know that you have to set the signal generator 50 dB louder in order to overcome the insertion loss of the T, the coupled port of the T, the straight through port of the T. In other words, the one with almost no insertion loss is going straight to the antenna. 50 dB down, you've got this T off to one side with loose capacitive coupling, and so as long as the signal generator is set 50 dB louder, it's the equivalent to putting the signal generator straight into the receiver as if the antenna wasn't there. Am I correct in that method of approach so far, Joe? The B2RYY, T2RW. By the way, Bird makes a nice product on this one.
Can I finish what I was saying? You took me right out of it. A Bird T is very expensive. I can tell you, make a T for $6 is highly accurate, comparable to a Bird, okay?
That's not what we want to hear now. That's not what we want to hear now. We're going into the details of the measurement he made. At a later time, we'll find out how to make this T, and very few of the amateurs listening are actually going to go and do that, as I see it.
Repeater, timeout.
From Joe's
beyond later. That's why I figured I'd just share it.
From Joe's point of view, he's trying to make a series of measurements. He's trying to understand them. He doesn't want to go off into an adjacent subject right now of how to manufacture parts to do that. That's a good discussion for another time. Not exactly at this time. That's what I'm trying to say, Hal. So, you did measure its insertion loss, this beautiful Bird T device. You measured its insertion loss at least at 450, and maybe you assumed you knew what its insertion loss was at 2 meters, because I think you're making the measurement at 2 meters. You do know the insertion loss at 2 meters, and you're compensating the signal generator that amount, Steve. I think that, here we go. Joe, to B2RYY, T2RIW.
The exact insertion loss doesn't matter to me at 52.525 megahertz. I'm not running on 2 meters, I'm running on 52.525, so I'm on 6 meters. That's number one. The loss across the tap, I know it's going to be worse at a lower frequency because of the capacitive action of the tap. The exact loss doesn't matter. You have to understand what I'm doing is, when I first set the generator up into this key, I'm using a 50 ohm load in place of the antenna, and then I turn the generator up until I get my 20 dB quieting in the receiver, in the I do that, I disconnect the 50-ohm load and put the antenna in place of it. Now, as soon as I connect the antenna, the signal generator level immediately goes away. It's gone. You don't hear it. I have to increase that level by 14 dB higher than what I had previously. And that level is what I continuously measure as I drive around from point to point to point. Now, do you get it?
Now that you've given me enough of the words, and you've had to say it maybe twice before I actually heard it, I think I do. You're using it at 52.525. You had calibrated, or you believe it's calibrated at 450. The difference between those two is a 3-octave difference, 6 dB per octave, 6 dB per octave, 3.16 octaves, 19 dB. So at 52.525, if all the laws of physics and capacitive coupling are being followed, 6 dB per octave will fall off. You've got 19 dB more insertion loss at 52 megs than at 450 where it's calibrated. So that makes the 50 dB insertion loss become 50 becomes 69. Big deal. Okay, so you set the signal generator, and you know how much quieting you're getting by your calibrated ear, so to speak. And maybe you're actually using an AC vacuum tube voltmeter on the output of the audio system. That's your choice. And that would be a little bit more exact. As you drive around, you notice that the noise power that you hear goes up in certain areas. How much it goes up, you find out by increasing the signal generator beyond the calibration point where you had, let's say, 20 dB of quieting. Am I correct so far in that understanding of what the measurement really is, Joe? The B2RYY? B2RIW. Good scientific measurement, by the way.
Yes, you are.
Now, if I understand you correctly, there are some portions where you drove where you saw the noise go up a significant number of dB. Tell me that number of dB of increase in noise power by your method of measurement that you experienced, Joe. Over to you, K2LIW.
There were some places where the noise level would change in the receiver and the recovered audio, and I stopped there exactly at the spot where it started doing it, and so sometimes it's only a space of maybe 20, 30, 40 feet, give or take, maybe even less than that. Maybe I'm just near something that's very, very low level emitter or emitting something, emitting noise on this particular frequency. Yeah, and at those places I had to increase the generator sometimes 5, sometimes as much as 10 decibels higher than my normal preset. And if you want to know what the generator actually was, it's something like maybe 1,000 microvolts on the generator output dial. That's what I ended up doing. You know, I didn't pay attention to the number because it wasn't important to me. I knew that I was putting an ineffective signal across the tap to do the test properly. Now, in other cases, like I said, when I got near some noisy junctions of either bad insulators and or whatever, I would really hear this making like a 60 hertz or 120 hertz racket in the background. At that point, I could take the antenna and put it right into the spectrum analyzer antenna and put the service monitor and optically see across, you know, 52 megahertz or so what I was actually listening to. I could actually see it. And that looked to be like spikes of line noise. But that didn't happen. But that didn't happen all the time. Like I said, what I was pretty much getting is this constant 14 dB above the sensitivity of the receiver wherever I drove. It really didn't change much. It never went less than that. It was always at least that much.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we've timed out the machine a number of times. We've got to be a little bit careful on that. I thought it was microvolts because of a potent signal. By the way, the 1,000 microvolts, that's not the number that you injected into the receiver. That's the number that you injected into this 69 dB insertion loss T, if I understand correctly. So we got to correct for that as to what it really means. Very few people, Joe, you're a crafty guy. Very few people would use an FM receiver with its built-in discriminator and limiter to try to make noise power measurements, interference measurements, electromagnetic interference. But it is a usable way of doing it. It's a little bit difficult to calibrate, as you're discovering. And as I said, if you reported this method of measurements to an agency like the Friendly Candy Company, they would look at you kind of skeptical. handmade, and now for you to use a directional antenna. Let me drop it.
Do you with a quick comment when you get a chance, Nick.
Okay, I only heard 2U, but I know what that means. That's Mike, W-Y-2-U. Professor Mike, we're going to hear from you in a second. So, the 1,000 microvolts that you had to turn it up to, we have to recalibrate that for the insertion loss. Unfortunately, because you're making the measurement of 52.525, you don't have a directional antenna. It would be nice if you had a 6-meter, 6-element Yagi on the top of your roof of your car with Armstrong rotation, and you can find out where the signal is coming from. I know I'm dreaming here. To make the measurement at 450, we really got the possibility of a directional antenna. And as you drive to a hotspot, you park the vehicle, you aim the antenna, and you find out, hey, it's coming from that particular building. And so what you're doing is a little bit more difficult, but still useful data. A little bit difficult to calibrate, as you're discovering. But I think we can turn all of the raw data you've gotten into a calibration. I'll bet you, Mike, you haven't heard very many people to use a FM receiver to make noise power measurements. WY2U, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and good evening to all. No, I have not. That's an interesting one, but I might be able to help my friend Joe out here. It took me a little while to find it. That's why I didn't chime on initially. I have an excerpt from a study that was done by the ITU in 2015. Actually, it's an addendum to an ongoing study, which basically profiles different types of noise levels as a function of frequency and tries to categorize them as to just what kind of noise densities they are, whether it's man-made noise or atmospheric noise or galactic noise or whatever. And then further, it regionizes it based on whether the measurements were done, let me open up the screenshot here, in the city or residential or off in the rural districts. And basically, I can just sum it up in one quick sentence. Let me drop. At 50 megahertz, by the way, the chart goes from 0.2 megahertz, this is the horizontal x-axis, all the way up to about 300 megahertz, and the y-axis is in noise power dB above KTB. So, you know, it doesn't matter what bandwidth you're in, it normalizes for bandwidth. Anyway, to make a long story short, at 50 megahertz in a city dwelling, I don't know exactly where Joe did the measurements, I'll give him two. In a city dwelling, believe it or not, man-made noise dominates, and it's something like 32 dB above KTB. Kind of a ridiculously large number, but that's what the median value seems to indicate. In a typical residential area, which is probably more in tune, I would gather, to what Joe has, it looks like it's on the order of 18 to 19 dB above KTB. And again, this is a median value. This isn't exactly what you're going to get, but evidently, those are the kinds of numbers that I think Joe could expect. So what he's measuring, it sounds like, and I agree with you, Dick, it predominantly should be man-made noise, and I think his measurements probably are right. Back to Net, WY2U.
Guy, thank you, Mike. Mike, is there an easy way you can tell us the URL of that particular website? It looks like it's got a handy chunk of data. WY2U, K2RIW.
Yes, I should be able to get you the excerpt, which is not the entire report, it's not the whole study, but it is owenduffy.net, owenduffy.net. I can't tell if it's a blog or if it's an excerpt. Anyway, that's what comes up when I just did the search. And it looks like the curve that Joe wants to take a look at is the first curve. The actual measurements themselves, if you read down a little bit, the actual measurements were done on a conventional receiver in a 2 kilohertz bandwidth low noise receiver. The measurements were made on a monopole dipole over reflective ground. So I guess that's pretty much in keeping to what Joe's seeing. And
and it's normalized, the y-axis then later on gets normalized to dB above KTB to eliminate the bandwidth factor. Again, owenduffy.net. Go ahead.
Okay. Did you find that by way of a Google search? And what was your search word? But owenduffy.net sounds like it gets us directly there. My guess is you may have found this by way of a Google search. And if so, what was the search word you used, Mike? W-Y-2-U, K-2-R-I-W?
I guess you realize there's no way I could have come up with that. No, I did a search on noise. Noise profile, man-made noise profile at VHF. And I think that's what got me here, about the third or fourth hit down.
Okay, noise profile, beautiful. And so that means, by that we're going to find, with a Google search, a couple of other couple of locations, but this owenduffy.net sounds like a good one. Okay, so that tells us what to expect. So it gave us a city reading, a residential reading, and there may even be a rural reading in there. So man-made noise at frequencies like 50 megacycles, from things like fluorescent lighting and power supplies for light-emitting diodes cool heaters and all kinds of things make lots and lots of radio noise. For Joe to pin it down, if he wanted to pin it down, a directional antenna would help. But to do direction finding for a noise environment at 50 megacycles is a little bit difficult. And so, I presume what started this all off, Joe, and correct me on this one, you're using, doing, let me drop it.
When you get your head stick.
Okay, you got some more. I presume you were doing digital TV DXing, and you knew that in certain directions your digital TV antenna was discovering all kinds of noise. One of the things that we're discovering about modern-day digital TV is it is rather vulnerable to impulse noise. It's very vulnerable to co-channel interference. So whenever you get a band opening, and a channel, and if you're people who are watching over the television, like Joe and I do, when a signal comes from over the horizon from an equal channel number but far away, and it gets mixed into your digital receiver, the digital receiver goes bunkers, and it says a weak signal. It'll give you a weak signal. What that really means is it's got a high bit error rate, which it thinks is due to weak signal. It simply can't tolerate impulse noise or another signal being present. So, Joe, I know you've got some additional information for us, and go right ahead. I said Joe, I meant Mike. W-Y-2-U, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, very good there, Dick. By the way, the profile does show five curves, A, B, C, D, E. A is a curve representative of city, B, residential, C, rural, D, quiet rural, and E, believe it or not, galactic. And that's what I wanted to point out, that at 50 megahertz, now I'm not sure whether or not the center of the galaxy is above the horizon when this measurement was being made or not, but interestingly enough, at 50 megahertz, galactic noise is 13 dB above KTB. That's quite a bit higher than I thought. I thought it was closer to maybe a couple of dB above KTB, but even at 150 megahertz, believe it or not there, Dick, galactic noise is still 3 or 4 dB above KTB. But again, I'm not sure what time of day and where the plane of the galaxy is when these measurements were being made. Also, 3 megahertz in a city environment. Wait till you hear this one. In a city environment, man-made noise at 3 megahertz is 67 dB above KTB as a mean value. My goodness. Back to that, WYTU.
I knew it was high, and I've estimated by numbers like 30 or 40, 67 dB in an urban environment. Wow. 60 dB is a million to one ratio. 66 dB would be a 4 million to 1 ratio. 67 is more than a 4 million to 1 ratio of excess noise power in a rural, in a urban environment. That's a lot of man-made noise. And by the way, when they talked about the galactic noise being that loud at 50 megacycles, Mike, I think they may have been using a directional antenna aimed at, say, Cassiopeia. I mean, Cassex. I think the Cassiopeia. I think is one of the noisiest ones down there. If they're using a directional antenna and they got all that excess noise, 13 dB of excess, I believe it. If it's a broadband antenna where an awful lot of the sky is quiet, I'm having trouble believing the center of the galaxy, which is only covering a couple of square degrees. There's 41,000 square degrees on the surface of a sphere, and only a couple of the square degrees is the center of the galaxy, which is super noisy. If you look at these radio astronomy charts that were done by Ohio University, among others. Let me drop.
Billy says the measurements are made on a vertical monopole antenna, which is kind of surprising.
Boy, that sure is. We know that the Penzias and Wilson experiment measured roughly 3 degrees Kelvin, 2.73 degrees Kelvin, across most of the microwave frequencies, galactic noise, broadband, all across the whole universe. And for down at 50 megafacals, that loud, with a broadband antenna, essentially non-directional antenna, that is striking. So, noise is complicated stuff, Joe, as you're discovering, but I know you're discovering sources of man-made noise. If you had the ability to use a directional antenna like you could at 2 meters or 450, I mean, to make a three-element Yagi on 2 meters that's Armstrong rotated with a pole coming down the window into the armrest of the car, so you could rotate it while you're driving, or at least stop and drive and rotate it, 450 or 2 meters, you've got a directional antenna. To do it on 6 meters is out of the question, if you wanted to pin down the actual building that's doing it. But it looks like we're slowly resolving that the measurements you're making, Joe, I believe are, to some degree, traceable to the Bureau of Standards. We're slowly agreeing that your technique is correct, unorthodox, but correct, and for the equipment you've got, it's a pretty crafty way to go. And I think your original question, is it real? I'm beginning to believe it's real, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, for what Mike just brought up, the information bringing to the net, I would believe that. And that's pretty much answering my question. It's basically, it is what it is. And there's nothing I'm going to do about it. What this really started from, by me doing this kind of test on the low wave frequencies, I used to like to listen to fire radio calls in the house, which were at 46.46 in Suffolk County. And I've been noticing that this level seems to be changing over the past 20, 25 years, or 30 years or so. I've been listening, maybe even more than that, because I don't hear stations in the distance as easily as I used to hear them with similar radio equipment, receiving equipment, like I did like from a long, long time ago. So something of this level seems to be growing and growing and growing a little bit each year, and I don't hear stuff as far away as I used to hear, and that's why I made this measurement initially. That's what started all this. Oh, yeah, I know on digital TV, when I put the analyzer on the antenna, I see all sorts of stuff out there, all sorts of impulse noise and broadband noise and stuff, so forth, as I put the antenna in different directions. So I can sort of trace it that way from the house and get an idea of my house and then, like, on a center line, approximately where it would be. To do that in the mobile, you know as well as I do, there's only one person that ever tried something like that.
For these rare individuals like Joe and I and maybe Mike, who do from time to time, and I do it exclusively, I watch television, over-the-air television. Because I'm on 300 feet above sea level land and I've got 100 feet of power, I have the ability to aim a television aerial such that I can receive television from Connecticut, Rhode Island, lower New York State, New Jersey, sometimes Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware. So over-the-air television, I got lots of channels to watch, you know, something like 50 channels. And one of the things you'll discover is that there are essentially no high-definition digital television channels below channel 7. The lower channel 2 through 6 are essentially not there in most places in the United States because impulse noise, man-made impulse noise, also rises 60 dB per octave.
Number 2 to channel 3.